listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. Bookwaves concludes its Black Lives Matter series of interviews with Ayanna Mathis discussing her 2013 novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. The 12 Tribes of Hattie is a novel, but it's actually a novel of interrelated short stories. Each of these deals with a person who is either the child or grandchild of this woman, Hattie Shepherd, who made the Great Migration from the South to Philadelphia, as did your family and many, many other African-American families. I understand that for a long time prior to Iowa, you were working on a memoir, or then a fictionalized memoir.
It was a bit of a mess, that fictionalized memoir. It started out as actually a memoir. It was basically these sort, I don't know what you would call them. They're almost like prose poetry. I wrote poetry for a long time, for most of my life, since I was a little girl. And so these were sort of autobiographical snippets and sort of bits of life that I was hoping to stitch into, you know, a larger memoir. And then the memoir just wasn't working. I discovered about myself that I'm not very good with a set of facts to which I must adhere. It tends to completely stymie me. It sort of tends to block my imagination almost entirely. I have a great admiration for people who can kind of write beautifully in that genre, because it does not work for me, as I discovered. And then I fictionalized it and then went to Iowa, etc. And then that project was entirely abandoned because, as I said, it just wasn't working. It was stiff and stilted and wrong. And then this book sort of came out of it. I didn't realize it was a book at first, but the stories that became the book came out of that abandoned memoir.
Which was the first story that you wrote?
It was a sort of a strange hybrid that doesn't appear in the book in its form at all. It was a kind of a hybrid between the first story in the book and the very last. So Hattie was present and her grandchild was present. And there was an allusion to the sort of traumatic event that happens to Hattie in the first chapter in the book. But it really was kind of a prototype, I guess you could call it. It didn't end up in the book as it was. But certainly Hattie's character to some extent was very present in that first iteration, I guess you could call it.
Did Hattie emerge somewhat from your grandmother, who sort of took care of you at times before your family fell out?
I think so. You know, Hattie is very, very different from my own grandmother. My grandmother had a kind of stoicism and a great sort of dignity and reserve, but Hattie is very different than she is. Hattie is much angrier than my own grandmother was, and much more sort of difficult, I think, than my own grandmother actually was, and more capable of rage, I think, than my own grandmother actually was.
Did your grandmother talk about her own experiences of the migration at all?
Not at all. I didn't sort of grow up with stories about the migration or stories of the South, none of that. Also, by the time I sort of came on the scene, my grandparents were born in 1910 and 1908, and they came to Philadelphia in the very early part of the 20th century. And so by the time I was born, they had been there for, oh, I guess, 50 years, maybe more. So it wasn't a thing that was kind of part of the dialogue or the stories of growing up at all for me.
In that sense, you had to do your research for what it was like at the time for 6 million African Americans to leave the South and come north for jobs and freedom.
Yeah, certainly. Isabel Wilkerson's incredible book, The Warmth of Other Suns, was very helpful to me. I think it's also important to say that the Great Migration really is kind of the backdrop, I think, to the book. I don't think that it's a book about the Great Migration. It really is primarily about this family. But of course, the Great Migration informs their circumstance.
It informs their circumstance in the sense that Hattie is the central element to each of these different stories.
Absolutely.
And it's Hattie's background in life, not just the tragedy that occurs in the first story, but everything that came before, that influences how these children grow up.
Certainly. I think that's certainly the case. She is enormously kind of formed and influenced by what happens to her in that first chapter, as we've alluded to. But certainly, I think, though particular issues of race are obviously exerting a great deal of pressure on these characters, they are also kind of externalized. They're sort of off page, if you will, or off stage, I guess, if you could use another kind of theaterish term. And I was very interested in doing that quite purposely because I didn't want these characters or their lives to be solely viewed or understood through the prism of race. I wanted them to have, first and foremost, their own very particular humanity and their own very particular individuality. And of course, if we're talking about black characters as we are in that time period, obviously, you know, there's this sort of larger world of the Jim Crow South and even of, obviously, the discrimination that happened in the North that is exerting pressure on their lives and on their community.
Hattie herself, Ayanna Mathis, how did that character emerge?
It's hard to kind of trace the evolution of an imagined act, you know? I've heard said, and I think it's very true, that often people are writing their first books their whole lives. I ended up abandoning the botched, you know, fictionalized memoir, and I thought, well, I'll just try and write some short stories. I am not sure, to this day, I don't really know where Hattie came from. She sort of appeared with this grandchild later in her life. The second story that I wrote, interestingly enough, I didn't understand that she was the life's blood of the book after having written that first story. I was probably about three in before I realized that this was actually a book. The second story, I think, that I wrote was Franklin, which comes later in the book, actually, and he was a soldier in Vietnam. What happened is that I kept writing these stories about these people who were, if not in Philadelphia, connected to it somehow in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And they kept sort of cropping up. And then at a certain point, I realized that they were all of a family and that Hattie was their mother. And so then with those first three stories, there was a process of kind of going back and understanding them a little more broadly and understanding how their mother was kind of influencing their lives and inserting her. And after those first three stories, she just was very organically a part of the book. And so she appeared in each story very organically.
The other story, was that just the separation of the Salas story and the Hattie story and then Franklin, or was there another story in there?
They were sort of separating that first kind of prototype story and fleshing it out enormously, because also that first prototype story, I think, was very short. As I recall, it was maybe 15 pages, something like that. I could have been six stories in before I really separated them. It was a while. Then Franklin, and then I believe the next story after that was Ella, actually, in which, of course, Hattie was quite present.
The story of Ella is actually the story of Pearl and Benny traveling north to get this baby who Hattie can't take care of.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. As much as all of the characters in this book, particularly Hattie and her husband August, have a very mixed relationship with the South. You know, August tends to be quite nostalgic about it, and Hattie just hates it utterly. And because Hattie is so strong, I became concerned about the book becoming sort of overwhelmingly anti-South. And I didn't want it to be that to be the case. And I thought that it was very necessary that there were people who were living in the South and who were successful in the South for those people to have an equal representation in the book. It seemed very important.
Yet at the same time, they're the ones who were virtually assaulted on their way north. Right. It's one of the most powerful scenes in The 12 Tribes of Hattie, Ayanna Mathis, that they're having a picnic and along come some white people and they're in a position to not do anything except try to escape with their lives.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That also, I thought, was very important, you know, because in as much as the book mostly takes place in the North, where that kind of, at least in the lives of these characters, that kind of overt violence and overt racial violence is not really present, it seemed also very necessary to in some ways illustrate or describe what they were fleeing from, you know, what Hattie et al. were getting away from.
At that point, we bring in the biblical notion of the 12 tribes of Hattie, which
sure.
is the exodus of the 12 tribes of Israel as a metaphor for the migration north.
Around that three or four story mark, you know, I sort of had these stories, and I was my roommate, who is also my best friend when I was in Iowa, which is where I wrote the book almost entirely, is named Justin Torres, who wrote a beautiful book called We the Animals. And so I had all these stories, and he's like, I think this is a book. And I was like, oh, come on, it's not a book. You're just so silly. That's not a book, you know. And then about week later, I thought, oh, well, you know, it is a book, you know. The title, however, oddly, though I didn't realize that I had a book, there was this notion of the 12 tribes that was sort of swearing around in the back of my brain, I think. I didn't think I knew how to apply it until I understood that I actually had a book and this is who these people were. And I was very fortunate because, I as you mentioned, I studied with Marilynne Robinson, who is very much a theologian, really. And so she used to let me go to her house. She has a library of a theological library, basically, in her house. And so I would go there and just kind of look things up and poke around. And I knew that I was interested in the metaphor of an exodus. But what I was also interested in, and which I think makes the 12 tribes of Israel so apt as a metaphor, is the idea that people would sort of come out of bondage into freedom and then find that freedom really is not at all what they expected to do. There's a lot of bumps in the road, and it is actually really quite difficult. And that, of course, is the case with Hattie and her tribes in this book.
One of the advantages you had is having created a character like Hattie, who is very distant and cold, it allows you the opportunity to create screwed up kids because they are going to be screwed up, which of course forms the basis of fiction.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, and it's interesting because Hattie also provides a unique opportunity to create a character that is at first glance perhaps not the most sympathetic character in the world. She is in that first chapter because she's just a girl and she's innocent and she's filled with hope and all these things, but once the sort of ugliness of her life begins, she is, you know, she's sort of encased in ice and she's angry. I find her to be actually very likable and I'm quite attached to her, but she provides an interesting opportunity because I think it's easy to sort of show the ways in which a reader will like a likable character. It is much more interesting to me to find ways inside a character that is not necessarily all that likable. It allows for an exploration of nuances and complexities that I found to be really rich.
Well, it also allows us as readers to let the character grow on us, because by the time we meet Floyd and Six, which are the second and third stories, it's pretty clear that their contact with their mother has been pretty negative.
Yeah, it is. Floyd, I think, is sort of the only living character, you know, aside from her children that die early on. He's the only living character that really has any experience of affection or tenderness with her, because when we meet Floyd, when he sort of comes onto the scene, it's not long after the her children have died, and she's essentially just sort of sunk into a very, very deep depression, and she sort of wanders around the house sort of disconnected from everything, staying in bed until noon or 1 o'clock, and just sort of really floored by what's happened to her. But because of that, the sort of icy wall that she later erects and uses to navigate the world, it's not fully in place when Floyd comes along. And so there's this tiny little window of time in which she is not necessarily affectionate, but she allows tenderness to be shown to her, which is, of course, a thing that she doesn't do anymore. And then by the time poor Six comes along, it's pretty much, you know, the ice is over the heart, you know, to quote that New York Times review, which I think was a very apt description. Though, what's interesting about Hattie is that she does display her love in very small ways when Six is sort of going off to become this itinerant preacher in the South. I mean, he has to leave because he's done, you know, something he shouldn't have done. She seems very angry with him, and then just before the car door is about to close and they're driving off to Alabama, she presses a Bible into his hand. That's sort of the most that she's capable of, but these small gestures are enormous for her.
Floyd is a pretty remarkable character. He's a musician who is also on the down low.
Yeah, he is. He is. He's struggling mightily with his sexuality. And it's 1948. He also is sort of itinerant. You know, he's trying to make a name for himself as a trumpeter and kind of juke joints in the South. He's really having an enormously hard time with it. He does actually very briefly get referenced in a later chapter, Alison Billups. We learn from that he has been actually fairly successful and that Hattie uncharacteristically has been clipping bits from newspapers and things like that when there are sort of appearances about, you know, articles about him or news of his appearances as a musician and sending them around to people, which is a massively un-Hattie-like thing to do, you know? So I think he sort of turns out okay in a certain kind of way. And at least we know that he continues to play his music and he's successful. We don't know what happens with his sexuality. It is my sort of hope, I guess, for him, because I don't really know what happens to him either, you know? I mean, my intention very much with these characters was to sort of zoom in on them at some very, very critical moment in their lives, to stay with them during that moment, and then to zoom out. And then, and sort of the silences and the gaps between the stories and the lack of connection between the characters is left both to the reader's imagination, and I think also is a function of some of the, I don't like the word dysfunction, but I'll use it, some of the dysfunction that, that Hattie passes on to her children, which is an absolute sort of inability to ask for help, to rely on anyone else. You know, I mean, these are a lot of siblings here. There are many of them, and they don't go to each other either in moments of crisis or of need, nor in moments of joy. They just sort of go it alone because that's the example that their mother gave them.
You're listening to a 2013 interview with Ayanna Mathis, author of the novel The 12 Tribes of Hattie. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves. Ayanna Mathis, maybe I'm jumping the gun here, but do you think you could actually leave these characters alone after this?
I think maybe, you know, which sounds such a funny, seems such a funny thing to do, but I think so. I you know, never say never. I mean, I can't know if maybe they will kind of come up in some way, shape, or form in subsequent novels. I don't have that intention at the moment, as much as perhaps a reader wouldn't necessarily think this, but they feel very finished to me, or they feel at least that in those moments in which I wanted to know them, I knew them or do know them as thoroughly as I could. I don't necessarily see returning to them, but you never know.
You have pretty much said that since you were a single child growing up with a single mother, and after the age of 10, more or less divorced from the rest of the family, as you were writing this book, these characters kind of became your family.
They did, in a certain sense. They were a kind of an attempt to, how would one say, create a context, I guess, you know, because certainly when you are an only child and you're raised by your mother, there are wonderful things about that, which are sort of a boundless freedom. You know, I didn't have anybody sort of saying, you need to be a doctor, or you need to get married when you're 20, or you need, you know, all the kinds of influences I think that family and neighborhood can have that form a person. I sort of didn't have any of those. So there was an enormous freedom for which I'm thankful. But at the same time, the flip side of that coin is a sense sometimes I think of being somewhat rootless. These characters, I think, in many ways were an attempt to create a kind of context, albeit a fictional one.
What kind of research did you do for the sections on mental illness, on tuberculosis, and on life as a down-low gay person in 1948?
I'll sort of tell an anecdote. When I was at Iowa, Edward P. Jones, who wrote The Known World, came. And people ask him about his research all the time, you know, because, I mean, that book is set in the 1850s, it's in Virginia, it's during slavery, you know. And he said the funniest thing, which was, you know, if you tell your reader with authority that they're in 1856 or whatever year it was in Virginia, they will believe you until you have someone answering a cell phone. And I thought that it was really ingenious because in many ways it's some of what I did. I did a lot of fact-checking. I didn't do a great deal of sort of original research. My strategy generally was to sort of write whatever my imagination dictated to me and then to go back and see if I'd said anything absolutely absurd, you know? And of course, like with the tuberculosis, that got researched. That was an example, of course, that got researched pretty early, like how would this be treated, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But generally speaking, I would just sort of write as, you know, imagination led me and then go back and make sure I hadn't said anything absurd.
Coming back to the religion thing again, the final story in this church, they're dealing with the book of Job. Mm-hmm. And there's a remarkable internal conversation that Hattie has where we learn that she doesn't even believe in religion. And that got me thinking about all of these black churches through America. How many people actually are believers, do you think?
I think it's unknowable, you know? I mean, and I think that belief is so vast and so complex, you know. People can believe in the power of a hem without necessarily believing in the doctrine of the church, you know. People can believe entirely in the doctrine of the church. People can not believe in any of it but follow it out of some sort of moral compunction or out of, you know, a kind of desire or need to conform to their community or to whatever their family dictates. It's a pretty complicated thing, I think. You know, my own grandparents were actually very religious people by the time I came along. I don't think that they were in their youth or even in their middle age, but by the time I sort of came on the scene, they were in their 70s, so they were both very religious by then. And I think that they were, particularly my grandfather, really very deeply believed, kind of fully. my own understanding of faith, which is very murky, and which is also why I think it's explored in this book, because I find it unendingly fascinating and a real inroad into kind of what it means to be a human being in some ways. I have been reading for many years James Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain. I don't know how many times I've read that book, many, many times. And the relationships that his characters have to their God is enormously complex. For some, it's just sort of a harbor or a refuge, not a refuge, actually, a place to hide, you know what I mean? Or an excuse for cruelty or an excuse for violence. Certainly in my book, that's not the case, but that book was very instructive to me in understanding a kind of very deeply Pentecostal, encompassing kind of religious experience and the complexities with which people come to those experiences.
Well, also Baldwin himself is of the generation of Hattie's children, too.
Yeah, he was. And he was a child preacher as well. I think at 14, he had a big conversion experience, and then he was a preacher in this kind of a storefront church in Harlem till he was 17 or 18, I believe.
And a closeted gay
and
man
also
as well.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot going on in his life. A lot going on in those early years.
When you were creating Floyd, was Baldwin a little bit in the back of your mind, you think?
No, I think Baldwin was much more in the back of my mind when I got to that last chapter, and he was also very much in my mind in 6. Floyd is an odd creation. I'm not sure exactly where he came from, and I've been trying to think about it because actually Floyd and Belle are my favorite chapters in the book. Floyd was one of the most difficult to write, that there are some of the instances where I kind of said exactly what I meant to say, you know, but I don't know where he came from. And once he sort of came to me and was in my mind, you know, I kept listening to Donald Byrd songs and, you know, and all these kinds of things to kind of help me along. But his origin is very mysterious to me. I don't know where he came from.
You just said that the Belle chapter is your other favorite. This is the woman with tuberculosis who mm-hmm. is stayed away from her family and wants nothing to do with them and would rather kill herself than get any help. Why do you think that's a favorite chapter of yours?
I just kind of like her. She's sort of snarky and snide, and she has a very dark sense of humor. She is also very familiar to me. You know, she's that sort of rare combination of people who are incredibly, she's very smart. She's incredibly self-aware, but that doesn't stop her in any way, shape, or form from doing things that are completely self-sabotaging and destructive, which I find really interesting and not that uncommon of a contradiction in people. But it certainly is fodder for good drama, I think, you know, just from a purely sort of narrative standpoint, you know, that there's a lot of richness there to build on.
I was reading one of your interviews, Ayanna Mathis, and you said that you had been having a little bit of trouble somewhere along the line trying to find the 12 tribes, trying to make them distinctive enough. And it's obvious from what you said, you don't want to get caught up in making this some kind of story of the black experience either.
Yeah, it was one of the challenges was stamina toward the end. I think probably the last 3 chapters that I wrote in particular, you know, Alice and Billups gave me a time. Oh, they gave me a time, those two.
But Alice was necessary.
Absolutely necessary. Absolutely necessary. And I knew that she was, which is why she was so labored over for so long.
Of course, she marries into money.
She does. And I think one of the other things that the book is about, and this actually helped me in when I was sort of getting low in the kind of creative well was running almost dry, was that I began to understand. I had this idea in my mind nearly from the beginning, but it became more and more pressing as I wrote, that this book is also about class. It's very much about class. And so it was absolutely necessary that someone, you know, sort of be removed and kind of marry out of that class into another one. She was very important in that way. She, I think, helps to underscore some of the class issues that are going on within the family itself. You know, I mean, Hattie is deeply classist, and among her other flaws, you know, she really does think, and she will sort of go for the jugular with August, she really does think that she is in some ways better than he is because she's very light-skinned and because her family that, you know, when they left the South, her family, her father was a blacksmith, they owned a business, they owned a house, they were middle class. And August's background is not a middle-class background. I think what happens with the characters in this book is that very clear hierarchies are formed, and they are class hierarchies. However, because we're dealing with the time period that we're dealing with, many of the characters were kind of in the same economic boat. So the hierarchies had to form on different, on a sort of a different basis, you know?
Right.
But it also became very important that one person at least, and that was in the form of Alice, actually marry out, you know what I mean? And become of a higher class in the more sort of conventional ways that we understand class.
Which brings together the notions of the relationship in America of race and class, which I don't think America has sorted out at all.
I don't think so either. I think one of the things that happens very often in America is that we don't like to talk about class, and we like to think that we don't sort of have these issues, which I think is absolutely just a load of poppycock. And I think the other thing that happens is that we are a country that is so, because of our long and very complex racial history, we're so kind of obsessed with race, but so also kind of unwilling to talk about that in certain ways, that we often cover class issues with race issues. It effectively prevents us from having to really deal with either one in a certain kind of way. We can say, oh, we don't really have class issues. You know, these are racial issues. A blanket is formed. You know, I mean, I think that class in the Black community is often not talked about or recognized. You know, it's like either you have kind of the Huxtables, you know, like in the 90s, right? Or the other extreme is, you know, projects. And of course, that is an absolutely inaccurate kind of view of the Black population in this country. But because we're so obsessed purely with race, oh, Huxtables, projects, and that's it. And we don't really have to deal with class or race in that way.
One final question about 12 Tribes of Hattie. Mm-hmm. How did you know you were finished with the book?
Well, in some ways it was very easy. The very uncreative, writer in the garret and the cold answer is just as I got to the last one, you know, if there were 12 tribes and I was, you know, I got to Saul and I was finished. But actually there was another ending. There was a kind of epilogue for a while that existed even when I turned it into my editor. And we decided, my editor has a soft touch and is very gentle, but is also very decisive and very smart. And we decided that epilogue wasn't necessary. I thought that I had to kind of go a little further with Hattie, but actually it was quite sufficient that we sort of see her as an old woman at this last moment of kind of extending some sort of grace to a child.
That epilogue, when did that take place?
It was much later. Hattie was very, very old. So it was, I want to say maybe 2006 or something like that. She was quite old, maybe 2005. I don't remember. It's sort of in a drawer. I wonder if I can use it for something at some point. She was an old woman. She was maybe like 99 or something.
She's looking
back at her life. But it was too, you know, it was really prosaic, and it was kind of like, oh, now we've sort of been with this woman through her whole life, and now she's going to look back and process things and have her regrets, etc. You know, it's just the Bronx chair, I guess, is not really a good radio sound. But anyway, it was too prosaic and too obvious.
And you're working on another book yet?
Very slowly. I have an idea that is super fragile, so I don't really talk about it because it's too fragile to be exposed to even my own verbiage. So it's sort of there at the moment because I'm on tour and doing all these wonderful things right now and also teaching. It's sort of at a standstill, but I'm very glad to know that I have it to go back to when things calm down.
You've been listening to a 2013 interview with Ayanna Mathis, author of the novel The 12 Tribes of Hattie. The complete interview will be available as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at www.kboo.fm. Coming up next is an encore presentation of the Black Book Talk episode from February 2015, Black History Month, with hosts O.B. Hill, Emma Jackson Ford, and Librarian Emeritus Patricia Welch.